Our next speaker is Jason Mitchell. He's a behavioral scientist at the Medical College of Wisconsin Center for AIDS Intervention Research. And his presentation is entitled Similarities and Differences in Strategies Used to Reduce HIV Risk Within and Outside of the Relationship Among a Large Sample of Gay Male Couples in the U.S.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Just to, I guess, bring some awareness, I switched institutions. I'm at the University of Michigan at the moment. And I'm going to be talking about risk reduction strategies that men have used within the relationship but also outside the relationship and whether any of those patterns existed. I don't have any disclosures. I'd like to acknowledge the National Institutes of Mental Health for the funding, previous center where I did my postdoctoral work, and then last but not least, the couples who have participated in the study. So a little bit of background. I don't necessarily need to belabor that men within these relationships in the U.S. are more at risk for HIV for a number of reasons, but the practice of UAI is mostly common within the relationship regardless of the HIV status. And that men engage in UAI for a variety of reasons, to increase their sexual pleasure, also for knowing the person well, to optimism towards current treatments for those living with HIV, and then just plain simply to show their love, commitment, trust within the relationship. And because HIV is so prevalent within gay male communities, men have adopted a variety of different strategies to either increase their sexual pleasure in order to reduce their risk for acquiring or transmitting HIV. And so these risk reduction strategies are basically used to negate condom use. And they include steroid sorting, strategic positioning, knowledge of the viral load count, and a person living with HIV on treatment. And so with steroid sorting, it's the concept that men are going to ditch using condoms if they have the same HIV status and perceive the other person to have the same HIV status. With strategic positioning, typically it's the receptive partner or the bottom being HIV positive and the insertive or top partner being HIV negative in order to reduce the risk of acquiring HIV from the top's perspective. And so prior work has shown that HIV-positive MSM use a variety of different strategies, including those three I just mentioned, and that mostly HIV-negative MSM use serosorting. There have been few differences indicated based on the race and socioeconomic status of the men. However, one study in L.A. Noted that Black and Latino MSM were less likely to use any of these strategies. However, it remains unknown to the extent that these men within the relationships are using any of these strategies with their main partners, outside the relationship, with casual partners, and or with both, and whether there are any differences that are extended based on the couple's HIV status. So why is this important? It's important because there's a current lack of HIV prevention interventions for gay male couples in the U.S. Also, most men acquire HIV within the relationship, and so there's a good need or important need to look at these strategies that the men are actually already using. So I conducted a study called the GuyTalk study, which is an internet-based national cross-sectional study that targeted MSM couples. It basically included 200 questions. I used a partner referral system so I can collect dyadic data, meaning data from both men and each couple, and all the recruitment was done electronically. I placed targeted paid advertisements on Facebook during the summer of 2011, lasted about 10 weeks. I incentivized every fifth couple and used three different images. Here's the first one, the second one, which is black and white in a coffee shop, and then the third one depicts more of a younger couple. And so the questionnaire asked a variety of different items on so many different topics, but what I'm covering today are some demographics, the sexual behavior, namely UAI, the testing behaviors, and then the risk reduction strategies, including serosorting, strategic positioning, knowledge of a person on treatment or has an undetectable viral load, whether condoms are always used for anal sex, oral sex only, and then because prior literature has shown that men don't use these condoms for just for like pure sexual pleasure, maybe this is also used within the relationship and possibly outside the relationship because they value pleasure more than risk. And so the study sample had about 1,800 completes. However, not all of those completes represent couples, so there's 361 couples, or 722 men. And of those, I'm going to be talking about 275 HIV-negative couples and 58 discordant couples. I will note that there are about 731 disqualifiers. A third of those were in the relationship less than 3 months, and less than, or 48% of them, didn't have sex in the past 3 months. In order to participate in the study, the couples had to have been together for at least 3 months and had to have had sex and report that they were gay, homosexual, bisexual, anything basically other than heterosexual. So for the demographics, this may be a little hard to see, but I'll just sum up from the individual level. These men were typically reported or self-identified as gay, white, highly educated with a bachelor's degree or higher for almost half of them. They were employed, lived in urban settings. 75% had health insurance. 77% discussed HIV status before a first UAI or sex with a main partner. And about a quarter of them also reported having sex outside the relationship in the prior 3 months. Age range was 18 to 68, average age is about 32. And then for the last average HIV and STI tests, there were about 2.5 years and a year and a half ago, respectively. On the couple level demographic characteristics, 57% were YMSM couples, a third were interracial, and you could see the demographic breakdown of where they lived in the U.S. About 30% were in the West, 25% or a quarter in the Midwest. For age difference, on average it's about 5 years between partners within the couple, and they were together on average about 6 years, and living together for about 4 years. So looking at some of the differences of UAI within and outside the gay male couples relationships by HIV status, most of the men had UAI within the relationship with their main partners. This is typically true for the HIV negative concordant couples. This isn't necessarily surprising, but there's a less percentage for HIV discordant couples. For UAI with a casual MSM partner, and then UAI within and also outside the relationship, there weren't any statistical differences between the two groups of men for these couples. I will note that I looked at UAI based on whether both men in the couple reported it or just one male, and for both men in the couple, there's a higher percentage who had done so within the HIV negative couples. And then similarly also for UAI within and outside the relationship. Looking at the strategies used within these relationships based on the couple's HIV status, almost a quarter of the men reported viewing pleasure or valuing pleasure over risk within the relationship, regardless of the HIV status of the couple. Two-thirds of the men reporting serosorting with or without withdrawal for the HIV-negative couples. And for the HIV-discordant couples, a third reporting using strategic positioning, and a quarter knowledge of treatment and undetectable viral load. And then for the couple level, I did an analysis that clustered whether the couple had used a strategy or did not, or used one strategy or more. And as you can see, 54% of the negative couples used one or more strategies versus no strategy, and then 41% of the discordant couples used one or more strategies versus 59% did not. So there are some subtle differences between the two groups of couples. For safer sex, using condoms always for anal sex, oral sex only, a higher percentage of discordant couples had used condoms in comparison to the negative couples, and there weren't any differences for oral sex. For the strategies used outside the relationship, almost half of the couples, for the negative as well as discordant, reported using stair sorting or strategic positioning. Nothing necessarily surprising about that. There weren't any statistical differences. And then for safer sex, half of the men in the negative couples reported using oral sex only, and similarly for the discordant men. And then condom use was more reported by those in the negative concordant couples. For the clustering, you'll note that 64% and 57% for negative and discordant couples report not using a strategy. And safer sex was also reported 65% and 80%. So I think with these two past slides, the men within the couples are basically reporting that they favored using at least one strategy within and outside the relationship. So I looked at, are there any patterns within the relationship and outside the relationship based on the couple's HIV status? For the negative couples, basically some men viewed or valued pleasure over risk, and that was true within the relationship, also outside the relationship, and that they also practiced serosorting and oral sex. So there are some trends. And what that really means is that if they're going to use one strategy within the relationship, they're more than likely to use that outside the relationship or with any type of partner. But I will note that you'll see the numbers, they're fairly small, so it's not indicative of everyone. For discordant couples, similar findings, except for similar in regards to pleasure, valuing pleasure over risk, but replacing serosorting with strategic positioning. And there weren't any differences about condom use or oral sex only. So in summary, basically within the couple's relationships, a higher percentage of the discordant couples reported not using a strategy in comparison to the HIV negative couples. Outside the couple's relationships, there weren't any significant differences based on the couple's HIV status. By partner type, within and outside the relationships, men in the negative couples reported most likely using serosorting, valuing pleasure over risk, or oral sex only. For discordant couples, it was strategic positioning and then valuing pleasure over risk. Because it was cross-sectional, we're not able to make causal inference, and because it was based on online internet study, it's hard to generalize. And also, one of the major limitations is whether the actual couples talked, or men within the couples actually talked about using these risk reduction strategies, either together and or outside the relationship with others, and do they actually come to some sort of consensus or agreement about it. So there should be a push about communication about sexual health and to integrate biomedical HIV prevention if consistent condom use for anal sex is undesired and or unrealistic. And to really better understand like what the dynamics are actually occurring within these relationships. Thank you.
We have about 15 minutes remaining for questions. I'd invite you to go ahead and ask a question of any of our speakers today, and I'll repeat it for the audience to be sure everyone can hear it, and then I would invite our speakers to clarify the question if you need to at all. So Eric reported that 15% of the men on Grindr were having, could you repeat the question, that part of it?
Right, so the question is the interest in HIV status relative to unprotected sex. We asked self-disclosed HIV status, and I believe that we got about, 10, I'm looking at Haley, this is one of my colleagues who helped me work on this study. We had about 10% who were HIV, who self-disclosed as HIV positive, but I don't remember, we actually haven't looked at that in this cross-section, and when we were looking at, we did some causal modeling of who is it that's most likely to be having unprotected anal intercourse when they have a grinder partner. And we did look at HIV status at that point, but it wasn't significantly related. What we did find was that there are two things that turned out to be important, or maybe three, and Haley can correct me if I'm wrong, because this is actually the paper that she's working on right now. One is that men who had been using Grindr for a longer period of time were more likely to be having unprotected anal sex. Men who had had more partners on Grindr in the last month, so frequency of partners. And what was the third? Oh, so then we also asked what was related to having unprotected anal intercourse if you were with the non-Grindr partner in this sample of guys. And there, the only significant predictor, but it was wildly significant, was whether or not you considered that partner to be a boyfriend or a life partner. So there really seems to be some pretty different motivations around unprotected anal intercourse for this sample, depending on whether or not you are in a Grindr partnership at that moment or a non-Grindr partnership. And thanks.
Yes, Rita.
Thank you, everybody. It was a really great panel. My question is for Stephanie. I was curious about the phones that you used, and I was wondering what the usage might be for interviews if you could record the video, record the audio, and also the cost.
So the question is about the video phones that were used in the study and what their implication or application for interviews might be, and also about the cost.
So yes, the video phones cost about $1,100, I think, when we bought them. It seems that the cost is coming down for those, and you just need a regular internet connection. We did, in some cases, purchase a slightly higher amped connection just to make sure that it would go well. But generally speaking, you should be fine with whatever the basic connection is you would get with your internet provider. The phones would be a great way to do interviews with people. We actually audio recorded our groups. We didn't record the video because of the confidentiality issues of having everybody's faces on them. We decided not to do that. So you're able to video record or audio record as you would like. So it would be a nice way to do that. There is a new technology, and I don't know the name of it, that actually does this same kind of thing on the computer, and they're selling it for specifically for doing qualitative interviewing. And so if I can find out the name of that, I'll send you an email. Thanks for your question.
Yes. So a methodology question about getting permission from Grindr, and then a second question about the survey.
These are actually both great questions, so I'll answer the easier one first. So it was an online survey, so we provided them a link. So I think that we might have had a slightly higher retention of the 25% of guys. So 25% of the guys responded to Adam's texts, and half of them actually completed the survey because they actually had to take a link to a survey gizmo survey, and for some of them they had trouble logging on. We ended up creating a little YouTube video, so we gave them a link to that too that would teach you how to log in, because we created a unique PIN that we gave everyone so that people couldn't take the survey twice. So you had to essentially have a password that we provided them. In terms of Grindr didn't want to have anything to do with us. And so we did it anyway. And our IRB was actually very cool about that and decided that, well, it's a public thing, you know, it's social media, and, you know, so long as, you know, you go on there and you're not violating the rules of the site, I mean, that's fine. And so at one point, we did get kicked off. Grindr has a no harassment policy, and so if anyone reports that you've been harassing someone on Grindr, you get immediately kicked off, and then your use gets reviewed by Grindr, and they determine whether or not you in fact were harassing and whether or not they'll let you back on. And so for us, they reinstated us within like an hour or two. We just called up their customer service center and said, hey, you know, we got kicked off. We're doing this study. We're not harassing anyone. And they said, oh yeah, go ahead. So it was interesting because on the one hand, their official policy was, no, we don't want to have anything to do with you. But then their unofficial policy was, yeah, go right ahead and do it. So I think that it was primarily, my take on that is that at the time, it was a very young company. We did this surveying actually, not this past summer, but the summer prior. So they hadn't been around for very long, and I think that they were a little bit uncomfortable about doing HIV prevention-oriented research on the platform, just in case it turned out that guys were using it in very horrible ways and that they were, you know, it wouldn't go well for them. I think that they've become an economic sort of might, I suppose, because they have a lot of advertising dollars. I think they've become a more secure company, and they've got a more social justice bent to them. So my hope is that as we move forward doing this kind of research, that they'll want to partner with us. But at this point, they hadn't.
Yes, please.
You know, unfortunately, we didn't ask that. So what we did with this survey was we were really self-conscious of the fact that we were asking guys to do an online survey for which they were only going to be getting $25. And so we really tried to limit this survey to being a half an hour or less, and we really viewed this study as a pilot study to then chase after, you know, a larger project from this. And so we tried to ask a lot of what we thought were critical questions about gay community involvement and about sex risk, but unfortunately we left some things out. In terms of the UCLA folks, there's actually two groups at UCLA that have done some work with Grindr. One group has done using their banner ads as a way of passively recruiting folks into a microbicide trial, and the other actually did exactly what we did at about the same time that we did, and their results, they wanted to look at things in a slightly different lens than we did, but their results are also very similar, showing that the rates of unprotected anal sex really aren't as alarming as folks might think, and that guys are definitely trying to protect themselves when they're using this.
We have time for about one or two more questions. Are there any other questions? Yes. Yes, one last question.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think what we decided to do was we decided to go out between 9 a.m. and 6 p.m., so sort of regular, you know, business hours, I guess, on Monday through Friday. And that we decided to do that mostly because we didn't want guys to, we figured that there's going to be less active Grindr use at that point in time because there's going to, you know, people may not be necessarily as actively looking for partners as they might be on a Friday night. But we also figured that they would probably be less likely to just ignore us because we weren't doing it on a Friday night when what they're wanting to use this, you know, the app for is to find somebody to hook up with. So it certainly could have impacted the kinds of responses that we got. I mean, one of the things is that when you pull up the software, you know, even if you're not actively using it, if you are nearby, you'll come up. So one of the things that we did miss out on was people that come to the neighborhood just to go and be a part of the social scene on a Friday and Saturday night, which is definitely one of the things that happens in gay neighborhoods all around the country. So we were really getting more the folks who live and work in West Hollywood, not necessarily the folks who come to West Hollywood to party.
Thank you. With that, we'll close. Thank you very much for coming this morning. I'd like you to encourage you to use the online mobile app to evaluate this morning's session. And please join me in thanking our speakers.